When I contemplate the immense advances in science and discoveries in the arts which have been made within the period of my life, I look forward with confidence to equal advances by the present generation, and have no doubt they will consequently be as much wiser than we have been, as we than our fathers were, and they than the burners of witches. Thomas Jefferson was as far-seeing as ever in 1818 when he wrote to Benjamin Waterhouse about the future of technological advances. He and Benjamin Franklin are famous for their scientific innovations, but other founders of the American Republic were also groundbreaking scientists. Who were they, and how did they better the lives of those around them? I'm Norman Gilliland.
I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What fields of science were the favorites of the founders as they saw it? What was the relationship between science and religion? What effect did the American Revolution and the wars to follow have on scientific research? And what was the difference between American and European science of the day? Our guest, once again, is John Kaminsky, the founder and director of the Center for the Study of the American Constitution in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Well, welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you. Good to be back.
If we think of the late 18th century or the 18th century in general, we think of it as the age of enlightenment, the age of reason, age of science. A lot of those terms get tossed around. Can you give us some sense of this time period and what role science played?
When the revolution was going on, the actual war, science took a back seat. The practical difficulties that they faced of winning the war was on everybody's mind. But once the war was over and the principles of the Enlightenment were weighing upon this generation, they thought that science would be a vehicle to explain the world to everyone. They had a concept that Newton had discovered the great laws of science and how the world operated to a certain extent. They wanted to do that on a political science basis, look for governments that would work the same way. But this had also a sense that we've got to understand how the world operates. There's a certain orderliness. Orderliness was very important to these individuals. And to understand how the great creator set the universe to work would give the people who understood that an avenue in which they could make life easier for themselves. And so to a certain extent, the revolution is fought to give us a government that would allow people to, as Jefferson said, pursue happiness. But the pursuit of science, the understanding of science and the investigation of scientific matters would open the door for making life easier and more pleasurable for people.
What were the big fields of science in which they were interested in late 18th century America?
First of all, they didn't use the word science when they referred to science.
Philosophy?
That's right. Natural philosophy was synonymous with a word we would call science today, and that would include astronomy and physics, chemistry, things of that nature. And then there was natural history, which had to do with living things. And so that would include botany, zoology, anatomy, medicine, things of that nature.
You've got a statement from Benjamin Franklin from 1743 where he writes, "The first drudgery of settling new colonies, which confines the attention of people to mere necessaries, is now pretty well over. And there are many in every province in circumstances that set them at ease and afford leisure to cultivate the finer arts and improve the common stock of knowledge. Now the noblest dreams of the Enlightenment could be pursued, the unlocking of the mysteries of nature to be applied for the benefit of mankind." It strikes me that last sentence, to be applied for the benefit of mankind, is kind of applied science justification, that let's study science but put it to use.
Absolutely. And this was the original thinking of Sir Francis Bacon, this great English philosopher and scientist and a politician who lived in the late 16th and early 17th century. And he advocated empirical science and thinking inductively and then coming up with practical uses for the science that you were investigating. And that was the primary goal of science, not science for its own sake, but science for the betterment of mankind.
Well, being in the New World, they had certainly, the founders, access to all kinds of phenomena that wouldn't have been available to the English, especially in the natural sciences.
That's true. And it was all sort of laid out there, ready to investigate. And you could see some of these individuals who were interested in science, men like Jefferson and others, college professors and university presidents, physicians. These are the men who are amateur scientists, but there are scientists. They are salivating at the potential that's there. The only thing stopping them is just, do they have the right amount of time, the leisure time to do this? Do they have the money available to investigate? Do they have the opportunity to converse with each other and debate these issues and thresh them out? These are problems facing them. But they all see that this is now what we ought to be looking at. No longer is it just survival. We're past that stage and we're to the next stage.
What role did Thomas Paine play in sort of developing a concept of scientific reasoning?
Thomas Paine, primarily, I think, when it comes to scientific reasoning, is involved with two things. One would be government and governmental principles. He certainly was looking to be the Newton of political science. But another focus that he had was as a deist. He is one of the handful of individuals who have come out of the closet. There are relatively few deists at the time because to be a deist labels you, in the eyes of many, an atheist. And so when you step out like that, there are problems that you face.
Well, how would he have defined being a deist?
A deist believes that there is a creator, that there is a God. So when deists are labeled as atheists, that's just not true. But they do not believe in the divinity of Christ. They certainly don't believe in the Trinity. They don't believe in the divinity of the Scripture, Old or New Testament. They believe that the Bible for a deist is the creation and the universe, just looking out in and understanding what's there. And the divine word of God is expressed in that way. They believe that there's a hereafter, and they believe that you must lead a moral life and that there will be accounting for you in the hereafter, depending upon how you led that life. So in many respects, they were very much like God-fearing people, except they didn't believe in the Christian God. And so Paine talked in those terms, talked in the creation, how it was created, how the creator was benevolent, that despite all of our actions and how we might be antagonistic toward God, God was kindly toward mankind in giving us the right amount of rain to nurture our crops. And so God could have been evil. He might point to the evil of the Christian God in the destruction of virtually the entire world in the great flood that took place. Well, Paine's God would not have done such a thing because Paine's God was separate. He created the universe and then stepped aside. And so that's how he looks at this from a scientific perspective. Jefferson does the same thing. And consequently, when it comes to evolution and the creation, there's not much difference between religion and the scientists at the time. There's not an antagonism that's there, partly because the deist perspective can be very easily accepted by a Christian who believes in God, just that their God, their creator, is a more personal God than the deist God. But the question of how the universe and how our own particular world was created was different for different peoples. In fact, Paine said at one time, every people has its own creation story. And that certainly was true of the founders of the American Society, and their perspective is that this great universe could have been established in one sort of stroke of the pen, or it could have been a gradual thing that took place. And Thomas Jefferson, interestingly enough, says, why must we think that the Creator came up with a plan, set it in motion, and then it took millions of years to evolve? Why couldn't the Creator just establish it that way to make it look as if it took a long time to create? If the Creator could establish it from the very beginning, why must he be forced to go in the beginning? Why couldn't he start in the middle? So Jefferson was not about to dictate to God how God was going to create the universe.
It sounds as if these voices that we hear from the time of the American Revolution and the years immediately afterward would not have had nearly the problem with, Darwin 60, 80 years later that so many of the Victorians did. They just seemed to have such a practical, almost nonplussed attitude toward scientific discovery and its relationship to religion.
I think what happens is during and after the Second Great Awakening, which is post-1812, you get a religious fervor throughout the country in which they view the Bible in a literal fashion. And when that takes place, then you get this hostility between science and religion. But before that, there was not only a mutual understanding between the two, but to a great extent, the ministers were the scientists.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so they were one and the same, so they wouldn't be opposed to each other.
There was another statement by Abigail Adams that I am reminded of, too, where she says something, in effect, that God obviously wants us to be happy because life is more pleasure than pain. And that echoes some things that are reflected in the letters between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, too.
Absolutely.
What about the metaphor that would be used to describe the way the world works? Because I've seen sometimes it referred to as like a great – the creator like a watchmaker who gets this perfectly intricate and well-ordered watch going and then steps aside. Did the American founders pick up on that kind of imagery or did they come up with something
absolutely,
else?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, some of them are watchmakers themselves. A man like David Rittenhouse, whose great contribution that made him so famous was the orrery, that is sort of a miniature planetarium, setting up the whole our solar system and how it worked. And you could adjust this with the gears and the cogs that were there to see what positions the planets known at that time and their satellites, what position they would be in 2,000 years. Now, at any one time, you can adjust this. And he was it was said that David Rittenhouse came as close as the Creator to creating an image of the universe as the Creator did. So it was a well-functioning machine, so much so that there was the sense of a continuity and that the creation that was made is non-changing in a certain sense. That is, there would be no extinction of animals. All we had to do was go and find them. The mammoth was not readily around, but it was there in the West. And all we had to do was look in the appropriate area where the climate was suitable for that animal. That's where that animal would be. And Jefferson says in a wonderful letter that it would be to think that any part of the great creation could become extinct would be a very scary proposition because by piecemeal, we could unravel and get rid of everything, including us. And so
I think he was onto something.
Yes, yes. So he was pretty adamant that there was a continuity from the very beginning. And species did not become extinct.
There is an instance in which the Revolutionary War did not actually put a damper on science. I gather Jefferson was very supportive of the voyages of Captain Cook, apparently.
Not so much Jefferson. He certainly would have been. But Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, as our minister plenipotentiary to France, issued a passport. Sort of a get-out-of-jail-free card, orders to all American ship captains do not attack this ship. And if you do attack this ship and you realize then what it is, this is an expedition of science. And science was above national origin. And so even when you're at war, the scientists, the men of science, are communicating with each other. Scientists in America, physicians in America are corresponding with scientists in Britain. There is not a hiatus in that discussion. They feel that this is not being traitorous. This is not dealing with the enemy, that men of science are above that. And so Benjamin Franklin did issue this order to all American ship captains that they should not interfere with Captain Cook's expedition that was going around the world, wherever he happened to be and wherever our ships were. This was forbidden territory for us to get involved.
What kind of differences do you see with the American approach to science and that in Europe?
There's two different levels of intensity, I think. And there's a number of factors involved. The ancient universities. I remember in the bicentennial era, our bicentennial era, I was on a little junket to go someplace, and I saw a friend of mine in the airport, and he was going to the University of Bologna, and he said it was their 800th anniversary, and I was celebrating our second 100th anniversary. So you see the order of magnitude here. And so you have these long-established universities. You have great libraries in Europe. You don't have those libraries to speak of. There's a handful of good libraries, but not the great libraries. There's the wealthy individuals in Europe, in France, and in Germany, and in Britain that are willing and often do sponsor expeditions to find different things. You don't have that kind of wealth in America. You have people who can, because of that kind of sponsorship, people who can devote their entire working lives to the study of science and that kind of exploration. You don't have that individual in America. These are amateurs for the most part. Even the physicians who are heavily involved primarily in botany as a science and then in anatomy naturally, they have to do their job first of being a physician to put bread on the table. And so you don't have the societies, the learned societies. They're starting. Benjamin Franklin is a big advocate of this with the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia in 1743. Emily quoted from that in the earlier part of the show. And it doesn't work out very well. It goes into dormancy. And it's revived then in the late 1760s. But you get in Boston, John Adams creates the American Academy of Arts and Science, which is sort of a mirror image of the Royal Society in London. The Royal Society in London has not only scientists from Great Britain, but from all around the world. And so we don't have these kinds of societies to any great extent. They're just getting started. And so England has this advantage over Americans, and the Americans want to emulate this.
Is it, to some extent, a bit of an advantage in America if you've got a lack of, you know, tradition, lack of societies in the sense that it might invite a more open exploration? In other words, if you are a sort of amateur scientist and you don't have to worry about what a royal society is going to think, are you going to see things in new ways, perhaps?
That could well be, but there is this sense of our scientists that they respect these societies, and their goal would be to get recognized. If you could do what Benjamin Franklin did to first of all, he won a medal from them, the Copley Medal, which is given out for great scientific achievement, not every year, but only when it's deserving. And then he gets a membership into the Royal Society. Now, this is something that everyone would like to achieve in America, scientists. But they realize that it's not going to happen. But I think you're absolutely right that there is an open plate here. And the men interested in science really are eager to explore and see what they might bring to the table. And there is a sense that this is fertile ground here and maybe some brand new things on the horizon that aren't available to European scientists.
We'll look at paleontology and archaeology and medicine and even some theories about racial origins as seen by the American scientists when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest John Kaminsky, who's filling us in about American science with the founders of the Republic as scientists in their dual roles as statesmen and philosophers, to put it in 18th century terms. Well, we mentioned, John, that in this vast American continent that was largely unexplored in the late 18th century, there were all kinds of things to discover that were not to be discovered in Europe. And foremost, probably most obvious among them, all those plants. That is something that would definitely require the orderly approach that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation.
Yes, and it's readily at hand. You don't have to have sophisticated scientific instruments to get involved in this, and all you need is a burning interest, and we had that in any number of men. Probably the two most important would be William and John Bartram, father and son, and they traveled throughout America at the time, going down into Florida.
1776, I think, just as the Revolution was breaking out, wasn't it, that they went down that way?
Yeah, but even before that, in the 1760s, they're traveling, and then into the 1790s. So it's they have about a 40-year career, the two of them together.
It must have been fun discovering brand-new plants and flowers everywhere.
Yes, but it must have been very painful and difficult to do when you don't have the interstate system the way we have, and just think of the difficulties of being in the swamp and the dangers involved and the hardships that you have to endure. And once you're there, you're not there for an hour or two or a day or two. You're in there for weeks at a time, let's say, having to endure the difficulties. One of the things that was striking to me that is so terrible for these people, you think of alligators and bears and these kinds of giant animals, but the mosquito.
Yes.
And the South, what they call the noceums, mm-hmm. now, the little gnats. These are things that just aggravate you to death. And in fact, they drive your horses crazy. And the Lewis and Clark expedition had great difficulty with mosquitoes. And so it wasn't terribly pleasant here. It was a real difficult task. And then to get the supplies you need, the food you need, all of this, it's just so much more complicated back then than we would have pictured it for us going on that kind of a sojourn.
And who's funding like the Bartrams? Are they doing it on their own or is it a government-sponsored?
No government-sponsored, not at all. And so what they do to a great extent is they set up a business. There are basically two kinds of botanists at this time. One is the collector, and that's who the Bartrams are. And the other would be the classifiers. And the Bartrams are the collectors servicing the classifiers. And so they are supplying scientists in Great Britain to a great extent, and also those wealthy individuals in Britain who have their elaborate gardens. And they want exotic plants from all over the world. And American plants sort of fit the bill there. And so they have a very prosperous botanical garden that they established just outside of Philadelphia. And that's their base from which they traveled out. And they find these different plants and they send them abroad and make their money that they need. Then they publish also.
An account of the travels, Bartram's travels.
Yes. Not as much as they hope to do. Partly their traveling impinge upon their publications. But every once in a while they would publish, and it would often be like a three-year thing. It would be, say, 1767, 1769, 1771. So they'd get back home and then they'd go again a little while later. And they'd publish these as a group. But that didn't bring in a whole lot of money.
Did they illustrate these at all?
Oh, yes.
With diagrams,
yes,
designs of plants?
Yes. And certainly the classifiers did as well in America and in Europe. And for the most part, I would say it was the Europeans who took the lead in American botany. That is, they came over and did the research as well. And they're the ones who are doing the publishing rather than the Bartrams or the American botanists. They're publishing far less than the Europeans. And what they'll do is stick to a certain colony or a certain region. And so you get an accretion of knowledge, this section of the country, that section of the country, that is developing from the botanical point of view.
Can you talk a little bit about the field of medicine?
Absolutely. We had probably about at the time of the revolution, a little over 3,000 doctors in America. Only about 200 of them had degrees. Almost all the medical profession served apprenticeships with other doctors for sometimes a very short period of time, maybe for a year or two would be the longest period of time. And then you can go out and practice. Now, the best of the physicians, often they came from a fairly wealthy merchant families. And these people, they had the wherewithal to send their sons to Europe to get medical training. And the most important site there would be the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And some of our best physicians went there. And they had their theories what caused ailments and how to cure them. Naturally, they had some of the old wives' remedies, some of the Indian remedies from the natural world, and they used these to a great extent. But they had their general ideas that there was something out of order, disorder in the blood, and the way to solve that problem is to get rid of that bad blood. And so that meant bleeding or blistering. Blistering would not cure the blood, but you'd put something caustic on the skin to cause a blister that would get rid of the infection that was in the inner body and get that out. And so these kinds of remedies often did more harm than good. Sometimes they did relieve the problem, for instance.
By killing the patient.
Well, distracting you from your original pain.
But, I mean, there are certain things that bleeding will do that is beneficial to the body. And even today, people give blood all the time on a regular basis, and it doesn't do you any harm. If you look at the Elizabeth Drinker diary, it's a wonderful diary. Over 60 years, she kept her diary. She's a Quaker woman who marries very wealthy, Henry Drinker. And you see that her husband has to be bled every fall and every spring. He gets lethargic if he doesn't, and this sort of peps him up. And so he goes and regularly has a bleeding session. But you can do this with diseases, and you can be very harmful in weakening your patient. And that's one of the things that Benjamin Rush did. He was so successful in certain regards, despite his theory of bleeding. And that was particularly true in the great yellow fever epidemic of 1793. He was quite heroic in staying there in Philadelphia when so many deaths were taking place, that people admired him for that. And he came up with a treatment that he guaranteed. And the treatment was, if you come to me on the first day that you experience the symptoms of yellow fever, he will treat you with purging and bleeding. Get rid of the problems in your body. And he guaranteed that he could cure you. Now, if you weren't cured, if you died of this, you didn't arrive in time.
Yeah,
it was your fault.
There.
You missed that leeway. And other people would say, well, when you cured them, they were never sick to begin with in the first place. Now, he disputed that. And he was under tremendous pressure for doing what he did. But then it's probably not until he was in the outs for a period of time and then in the ins. It's not until the 1820s that bleeding is roundly condemned and you don't do this anymore.
Now, Rush did become known as the father of American psychiatry, though, right?
Absolutely. And he got involved in this from a personal basis as well as a professional basis. That is, there is a mental institution for the insane in Philadelphia. And he sees how badly patients are treated. And his heart goes out to that, both his personal side and his professional side, and something must be done. And he develops a theory. Again, it's the blood in the brain that is causing this problem, and it must be addressed. But his son, his eldest son, is – I believe he was in New Orleans at the time, and he gets involved in a duel with a friend, kills the friend, and this sort of tips him over. and he's not right mentally. He comes back to Philadelphia and eventually is admitted to this institution. And so he works with his son to try to help him. And he develops a chair. It looks like an electric chair the way it's with straps. And this is a way to hold the patient steady so that you can treat them without them hurting themselves. But it looks like an inquisition that's there. But it is on the path toward a more humane treatment of individuals with mental health problems.
Always when you look at the sort of early American Republic, there's this sort of noble call for freedom, spirit of inquiry and all kinds of things that we can feel proud of. But there's this other side too. And can you talk a bit about some of the theories on race and how the science was used in not so positive ways?
Well, you put it that way, and that's the way we look at it today. But that's not the way it was looked at back then. This is science. And science at that time is very much, it's held in regard very much the way we hold DNA. That is, it is irrefutable. The evidence that comes from DNA is gospel. And that's the way many people thought of as science at the time. And so when science is coming up with these theories of race, if you believe this, you believe this is true, and you don't have the stigma that we attach to it today. I hear different people refer to it as quasi-science. It wasn't quasi-science at the time. It was real science. And so we have obviously come a long way since then. But there are various interpretations at the time of how the races began. You have those who believe that the origins of man is a one-time proposition, whether this is from a deist perspective, whether it's from a Christian perspective, or whether it's from not from a creator at all, whether there's a spontaneous creation of life from the ooze that was there and various elements coming together. But it was a one-time deal, and everything then evolved from that. But then there's the other side, that there are different spontaneous creations of individuals, and the races are formed from that. Generally, the monotheists here, those who believe in one-time origins, they, I think, hold sway, and they believe that it's a combination of two things. One is climate that causes a differentiation of races, and the other is the state of the society that they're in. And that entails any number of things. It entails their type of government, their manners, their civilization. How advanced have they become? And those who are more advanced, obviously, are going to have the more appropriate attributes. And obviously, in their point of view, that was the attributes of European whites. And so you would have the interpretation that we all started from the same origins, and some went up in civilization and others went down. And the other side is that they were separate and they all developed at different rates of speed and developed for different environments that they happened to be in. And if you were in a hot climate like Africa, then the skin would have to develop certain immunities to the sun.
Well, they were on target there.
And so there is a semblance of Darwinian evolution that is just starting and gets sort of a leap forward in the 1820s. But there is the sense that there is a natural selection of sorts, but it's not really pursued to any great extent until after the 1820s.
Well, in connection with that, what did the founders think about the various Indian ruins that were still in evidence at the time? Was this a theory that these were done by the same race as the current Indians or some superior race that had vanished or moved out?
Very, very few thought that these mounds that were prevalent throughout the Middle West of the present United States, very few believed that these were done by the Indians of the time or their direct ancestors. There was there were a number of different possibilities brought forth. One was there was a race of people that came across from the Bering Strait, and they populated Mexico, and then they went into the what would become the United States, and even down into South America. They were the forefathers of the Aztecs and the Incas and this people who created these mounds. There were generally two kinds of mounds. There were thousands of smaller ones, and that was supposedly a certain people that established them. But then there were about 3,000 very, very large mounds. Another interpretation was that these were fortifications built by Ferdinand de Soto.
Busy guy.
Yes. Now, most people didn't think he got up that far. And most people realize, if you know anything about the Spanish conquistadors, they weren't fort builders. And so this is not a theory that holds too many to that belief. One of the great scientists of the time, Benjamin Barton, believed that because of the inscriptions and the designs of these mounds, that these must have been Danes that came over from Denmark, the precursors of the Vikings, let's say, as Scandinavians. But they came over, and eventually they went from Middle West America to Mexico and then down to South America. He changes his point of view and believes that maybe they went first to these other places and then they came to America. So there's a variety of them. And Jefferson does what he usually does. He's experimenting on his own at the base of his Monticello, at the base of his little mountain, the Ravenna River. There's a mound, and he's excavating there on his own dime, his own money, investigating. And he says, we've got to investigate. We just don't know what it is, and it's premature to put forth these theories. We just need more investigation.
We're going to look at balloons, cotton gins, and some experiments of Benjamin Franklin when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. All the people are running after air globes. The invention of them may have many consequences, and who knows but travelers may hereafter literally pass from country to country on the wings of the wind. That's John Jay writing in 1783. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is John Kaminsky, and we are talking about science in the age of the American Republic with the founders. So what were some of the flashy inventions of the time?
Well, these balloons certainly were fit that category, as you can imagine. Just think, no one living at that time had gone above about 10,000 feet. That's as high as they got up on the highest mountain. George Washington probably never got above 5,000 feet above the surface of the planet. I mean, these people were tied to the ground, and there's a big question, how did these mound makers make these mounds that you needed a perspective of up on high? No one at the time thought of extraterrestrials. No one put forth that idea. That is what some people say today. But with balloons, people would be going up, and they could see readily that they go up 1,000 feet, they go up 4,000 feet. There's a danger. And in fact, some people are killed in doing this, but that's a danger that's there. Benjamin Franklin says, this is a new deterrent, sort of like the atomic weapons that we had was the deterrent. But if people countries could have a fleet of balloons, and he uses the number of 5,000, if you have 5,000 balloons, would cost you less than five ships, five men of war. And you put two men in each balloon, that's an army of 10,000. And you can fly over another country and land and be attacked at the weakest point in that country. This will bring eternal peace to the world. Balloons will have this effect. And certainly, as John Jay mentioned, traveling and commerce, the danger will have to rethink much of how we do business, because we won't have the ability to collect tariffs at the shore. The smuggling will be able to be done. I mean, we see this with drug smuggling into the country using small planes. Well, that's what they theorize balloons could do in smuggling goods into the country. So that was and just the idea of getting us off the surface and getting up and seeing, first of all, could you survive at 1,000 feet in the air? Just as when the first spaceships went up, they sent up dogs and monkeys. Could they survive in outer space, even with the protections they had? And so that was a great machine. You had steam being invented at the time, steam engines and steam boats that are just being started. There's races with different men involved, John Fitch and others, and Robert Fulton eventually, to develop a viable steamship. And so that's happening at the time. 1787, when the Constitutional Convention is meeting, you have the first steamship. In war, you have the first submarine established, and the Turtle, by a student at Yale University. He comes up, Yale College at the time. He comes up with this plan. It's a vertical machine, and it works with pedals on pumps that you have. But the idea was to get close to a ship and then attach a time bomb to the ship. And so it didn't work out very well as far as a weapon of war, but it was a good submarine. It did operate underwater, and only the periscope and two ventilation tubes to get your oxygen were on the surface. And so obviously one of the great inventions that changed everything in America was the cotton gin, invented in 1793. And what it did was just to find a way, a viable, easy, and economical way to remove the seeds from the cotton ball. And with that, cotton became a valuable crop, much more so than it was before. And so you have a whole new crop that slaves can grow economically. If that wasn't invented, the economic reasons for slavery would have ended. And who knows what would have happened to the institution of slavery. Obviously, it was dying in the North. But if you have tobacco and indigo as the primary crops for slaves, tobacco is very harsh on the land, and slaves very costly to own, perhaps emancipation would have taken place. You have the whole racist issue, however, that's a, sort of a wild card on top of that. But the cotton gin did give the economic reason for the preservation of slavery.
So how big a chance was Benjamin Franklin taking when he experimented with electricity?
It was a dangerous thing that he did with his experiment with the kite and the key. He explained how he did that. This is not the only experiment. A Russian who did this shortly afterwards was electrocuted and died. And so it was dangerous. But he, more than anybody at the time, understood the principles of electricity. It's just astounding. And in his little pamphlet that he wrote on this, if you read it today, it has a resonance you can understand. I'm not a scientific person. And if I read a technical description of what electricity is, even from a scientist today, I might have difficulty following that. But I had no difficulty following what Benjamin Franklin said about it. And I think that was one of his genius, one of his strokes of genius, that he could communicate so effectively the way he did with Poor Richard's Almanac. He was able to do this in a more serious fashion with his science. And he did that with electricity. He created terms that survive today: charge and positive and negative and conduction and conductors. These are things, words that Franklin created for the description of what he wanted to get across. And what he did also all the time, he's involved in this Baconian philosophy of science for utilitarian purposes. So it wasn't just let's find out in general theoretical terms, but he wanted to apply. And one of the things he did apply was lightning rods. And so he developed a way to save buildings. And this is such an important thing, especially in a society where you have so many wooden structures. So if one house gets struck and is on fire, it endangers the entire community. And this is also a time when there's virtually no insurance. And so if your house is struck and damaged, you lose everything that you might have. So this is very important.
And where is Franklin getting his ideas? I mean, is he reading a bunch of European books, or is he kind of observing? Where does he come up with his lightning rod and some of his ideas?
A lot of this is original with him. Mm-hmm. And he is in the vanguard. There's a small number of scientists that are investigating this subject of electricity. He's not alone by any means, but he's reading that. But he is one of the leaders in this field. He's not following. And he has a certain technique that he has. He is the real scientist. He proposes a theory and he puts that into effect with an experiment. And he talks about, you would think you're reading Edison, that so many failures occur before you get success. And that's what happens with him. He comes up with these theories and he has a remarkable insightfulness. He can see these things when most other people can't. And it's interesting to me with this lightning rod. He tries the sharpened, pointed lightning rods versus the blunted,
right,
rounded lightning rods. And he figures that he comes up with the pointed ones are far superior. But when the American Revolution is coming upon us and Franklin is forced to leave Britain in disgrace because of his activities as a revolutionary, the king orders all pointed lightning rods to be taken off of royal property. Franklin suggested he might even take away all blunted lightning rods as well, and that might be better.
Did Franklin discover the Gulf Stream?
No, he didn't discover it, but he mapped it out. He, as deputy postmaster general of the colonies, was asked by the British Board of Trade, how do you explain the fact that ships coming from America, often with American captains, take 2 weeks less to transit from America to Europe than European or English captains going from Britain to America? And so he couldn't understand that, but he started experimenting, not just himself, but he commissioned captains to take readings, temperature readings at different levels, and also the current that was going on. And so what he does after, about 7 years of this, he draws a map of the Gulf Stream, which is just remarkably accurate today. And the Gulf Stream, for people who don't know what it is probably best described as a river within the ocean. And there is more water in that river of the Gulf Stream than in all the rivers of the world. It's that gigantic. And the first person that we know of who, if you want to say, discovered the Gulf Stream, at least in historical writing, is Ponce de Leon.
1513. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And the how he discovered it was he was sailing south toward an island, and he had the wind behind him. But the wind was a very mild wind. It was only about 2.5 knots. And after several hours, instead of being closer, he was further away from the island. And he knew something was going on here that in the water that was taking him away from the island, even though the wind was pushing him toward the island. And so they mapped this out, the Spanish. And they knew about it for a long time, but kept it secret for military reasons. And their galleons that went back and forth, when they went from west to east, they went in the Gulf Stream. And when they went east to west, they stayed out of the Gulf Stream so that they could take advantage of this in one direction and avoid the detriment of, in essence, not a headwind. We face the same thing with airplanes, headwinds and tailwinds today, but this is in the water.
And if Franklin is known for working in the area of electricity and on the Gulf Stream, what about Thomas Jefferson? What would you say would be his major areas of contribution to science?
I would say, first of all, he's an expediter. He is helping other scientists develop their programs, and he's an advocate, not an advocate for government involvement because he doesn't believe government should be involved, particularly under the new Constitution. He would love to see an amendment to the Constitution saying that there should be a furtherance of scientific investigation. That's part of the role of government. But as long as there's not, he will not be an advocate. And so he's not an advocate of a national university. The other presidents, the other first six presidents, for five out of six except for Jefferson, they do advocate a national university. But Jefferson, for constitutional reasons, does not. But he's an expediter. He encourages others. It's interesting that every science has its vocabulary. And Jefferson is able to converse with the great scientists throughout the world in their vocabulary. And he is viewed by them not as a dilettante in this host of fields that he's involved in, but as an equal. There's a wonderful exchange of letters. A man by the name of John Manners writes to Jefferson and doesn't know him, and asks him out of the clear blue sky, what do you think about the different plans for classification of animals and plants? The Linnaeus classification is holding forth at this time, but there are four or five others. And Jefferson turns around, this person he doesn't know at all, he writes a 10-page response, unbelievable, in which he gives his explanation of these and why this one might be a little bit better than that. But the Linnaeus approach has certain advantages. That is, it's open-ended. It's accepted by virtually everybody. We can insert different things that come about new. And so for this reason, we ought to go with that. But he says the great creator doesn't need this kind of classification. It's we human beings who are so short in memory that we have to classify things together to try to understand them. But the great creator, he says, understands everything is unique. Every blade of grass is unique. And so every human being was distinct. And so there can be generalities of plants and animals. And so certainly he would say that blacks are inferior to whites. But he would say there are certain anomalies that are there. And so certain individuals might leapfrog above. Same way women are inferior to men in different regards. But there are some exceptions to that. So an Abigail Adams will leap over many men and will have traits that are more admirable. But what Jefferson does is he responds to a French diplomat's request for information. This is in the beginning of the American Revolution, late 1770s. Jefferson is the only American that responds in full to 22 questions. And this is describing his colony, his state, Virginia. And this is a scientific study here that he's bringing forth about all areas of science. And this is a great book. It sets the issues for the next 50 years. All of science looks toward Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia to see what are the issues that should be investigated. And he touches almost all of them. There are a handful that he doesn't touch, but he doesn't touch them, like chemistry being one of those and physics being another, because he wasn't asked a question on that. And so if he had been asked a question, he would have developed that as well. And one of the things he does, he takes the occasion to prove that the Count Buffon in France was wrong in his interpretation that everything in the New World was degeneration from the Old World. And in fact, this was carried further by the Abbe Raynal, who said Europeans who went to America had a retrogression in their state that they were in. And Jefferson shows that this is not true. At his own expense, he gets a moose from New Hampshire. He gets a friend, John Sullivan, to send the moose bones and skull and hide to France to show we've got gigantic animals here. It's interesting to see how Buffon and Raynal would argue this. These are men who are typical in size, about 5'5 or 5'6, and you can see them on a stage debating with Thomas Jefferson at 6'3 that somehow Americans are degenerate here in every aspect. So Jefferson puts that forth as one of his great contributions.
Well, thank you, John Kaminsky, for your contribution to our understanding of science among the founders of the American Republic. Been a pleasure having you with us again.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.